Chapter 5. The peace of Amiens. Many a woman's knee was on the ground, and many a woman's soul spent itself in joy and thankfulness, when the news came with the fall of the leaf in 1801, that the preliminaries of peace had been settled. All England waved her gladness by day, and twinkled it by night. Even in Little Friar's Oak we had our flags flying bravely, and a candle in every window, with a big G. R.R. guttering in the wind over the door of the inn. Folk were weary of the war, for we had been at it for 8 years, taking Holland, and Spain, and France each in turn and all together. All that we had learned during that time was that our little army was no match for the French on land, and that our large navy was more than a match for them upon the water. We had gained some credit, which we were sorely in need of after the American business, and a few colonies, which were welcome also for the same reason, but our debt had gone on rising, and our consul sinking, until even Pitt stood aghast. Still, if we had known that there never could be peace between Napoleon and ourselves, and that this was only the end of a round, and not of the battle, we should have been better advised had we fought it out without a break. As it was, the French got back the 20,000 good seamen whom we had captured, and a fine dance they led us with their bowling flotillas and fleets of invasion, before we were able to catch them again. My father, as I remember him best, was a tough, strong little man, of no great breadth, but solid and well put together. His face was burned of a reddish color, as bright as a flower pot, and in spite of his age, for he was only 40 at the time, of which I speak, it was shot with lines, which deepened if he were in any way perturbed, so that I have seen him turn on the instant from a youngish man to an elderly. His eyes especially were meshed round with wrinkles, as is natural for one who had puckered them all his life in facing foul wind and bitter weather. These eyes were, perhaps, his strangest feature, for they were of a very clear and beautiful blue, which shone the brighter out of that ruddy setting. By nature he must have been a fair-skinned man, for his upper brow, where his cap came over it, was as white as mine, and his close-cropped hair was tawny. He had served, as he was proud to say, in the last of our ships which had been chased out of the Mediterranean in 97, and in the first which had re-entered it in 98. He was under Miller, as third lieutenant of the Theseus, when our fleet, like a pack of eager foxhounds in a covert, was dashing from Sicily to Syria and back again to Naples, trying to pick up the lost scent. With the same good fighting man he served at the Nile, where the men of his command spawned and rammed and trained until, when the last tricolor had come down, they hove up the sheet anchor, and fell dead asleep upon the top of each other under the capstan bars. Then, as a second lieutenant, he was in one of those grim three-deckers with powder-blackened hulls and crimson scupper holes, their spare cables tied round their keels, and over their bulwarks to hold them together, which carried the news into the Bay of Naples. From thence, as a reward for his services, he was transferred as first lieutenant to the Aurora frigate, engaged in cutting off supplies from Genoa, and in her, he still remained until long after peace was declared. How well I can remember his homecoming! Though it is now 8-40 years ago, it is clearer to me than the doings of last week, for the memory of an old man is like one of those glasses which shows out what is at a distance, and blurs all that is near. My mother had been in a tremble ever since the first rumor of the preliminaries came to our ears, for she knew that he might come as soon as his message. She said little, but she saddened my life by insisting that I should be forever clean and tidy. With every rumble of wheels too, her eyes would glance towards the door, and her hand steal up to smooth her pretty black hair. As he had embroidered a white elcum upon a blue ground, with an anchor in red upon each side, and a border of laurel leaves, and this was to hang upon the two lilac bushes which flanked the cottage door. He could not have left the Mediterranean before we had this finished, and every morning she looked to see if it were in its place and ready to be hanged. But it was a weary time before the peace was ratified, and it was April of next year before our great day came round to us. It had been raining all morning, I remember, a soft spring rain, which sent up a rich smell from the brown earth, and pattered pleasantly upon the budding chestnuts behind our cottage. The sun had shone out in the evening, and I had come down with my fishing rod, for I had promised Boy Jim to go with him to the mill stream, when what should I see but a postchaise with two smoking horses at the gate, and there in the open door of it were my mother's black skirt, and her little feet jutting out, with two blue arms for a waist belt, and all the rest of her buried in the chaise. Away I ran for the motto, and I pinned it up on the bushes as we had agreed. But when I had finished, there were the skirts, and the feet and the blue arms just the same as before. "Here's Rod," said my mother at last, struggling down onto the ground again. "Oddie, darling, here's your father." I saw the red face and the kindly, light blue eyes looking out at me. "Why, Roddy, lad, you were but a child and we kissed goodbye when last we met. But I suppose we must put you on a different rating now. I'm right glad from my heart to see you, dear lad. And as to you, sweetheart," the blue arms flew out, and there were the skirt and the 2 feet fixed in the door again. "Here are the folk coming, Anson," said my mother, blushing. "Aren't you get out, and come in with us?" And then suddenly it came home to us both that for all his cheery face he had never moved more than his arms, and that his leg was resting on the opposite seat of the chaise. "Oh, Anson, Anson," she cried. "Tut, 'tis but the bone of my leg," said he, taking his knee between his hands and lifting it round. "Got it broke in the bay, but the surgeon has fished it and spliced it, though it's a bit crank yet. Why, bless her kindly heart, if I haven't turned her from pink to white. You can see for yourself that it's nothing." He sprang out as he spoke, and with one leg and a staff he hopped swiftly up the path, and under the laurel be ordered motto, and so over his own threshold for the first time for 5 years. When the postboy and I had carried up the sea chest and the 2 canvas bags, there he was sitting in his armchair by the window in his old weather-stained blue coat. My mother was weeping over his poor leg, and he patting her hair with one brown hand. His other he threw round my waist, and drew me to the side of his chair. "Now that we have peace, I can lie up and refit until King George needs me again," said he. 'Twas a carronade that came adrift in the bay, when it was blowing a topgallant breeze with a beam sea. Ere we could make it fast it had me jammed against the mast. "Well, well," he added, looking round at the walls of the room, "here are all my old curios, the same as ever. The narwhal's horn from the Arctic, and the blowfish from the Moluccas, and the paddles from Fiji, and the picture of the Kaira with Lord Hotham in chase. And here you are, Mary, and you also, Roddy, and good luck to the carronade which has sent me into so snug a harbor without fear of sailing orders." My mother had his long pipe, and his tobacco all ready for him, so that he was able now to light it, and to sit looking from one of us to the other, and then back again, as if he could never see enough of us. Young as I was, I could still understand that this was the moment which he had thought of during many a lonely watch, and that the expectation of it had cheered his heart in many a dark hour. Sometimes he would touch one of us with his hand, and sometimes the other, and so he sat, with his soul too satiated for words, whilst the shadows gathered in the little room, and the lights of the inn windows glimmered through the gloom. And then, after my mother had lit our own lamp, she slipped suddenly down upon her knees, and he got one knee to the ground also, so that, hand in hand, they joined their thanks to heaven for manifold mercies. When I look back at my parents as they were in those days, it is at that very moment that I can picture them most clearly. Her sweet face with the wet shining upon her cheeks, and his blue eyes upturned to the smoke-blackened ceiling. I remember that he swayed his reeking pipe in the earnestness of his prayer, so that I was half tears and half smiles as I watched him. "Roddy, lad," said he, after supper was over, "you're getting a man now, and I suppose you will go afloat like the rest of us. You're old enough to strap a dirk to your thigh, and leave me without a child as well as without a husband," cried my mother. "Well, there's time enough yet," said he, "for they are more inclined to empty berths than to fill them, now that peace has come. But I've never tried what all this schooling has done for you, Rodney. You have had a great deal more than ever I had, but I dare say I can make shift to test it. Have you learned history?
Yes, father, said I, with some confidence.
Then how many sail of the line were at the Battle of Camperdown?
He shook his head gravely when he found that I could not answer him.
Why, there are men in the fleet who never had any schooling at all who could tell you that we had 774s, 764s, and 250 gunships in the action.
There's a picture on the wall of the chase of the Kaira, which were the ships that later aboard.
Again I had to confess that he had beaten me.
Well, your dad can teach you something in history yet, he cried, looking in triumph at my mother.
Ave, you learned geography?
Yes, father, said I, though with less confidence than before.
Well, how far is it from Portman to Algeciras?
I could only shake my head.
If Ushant lay 3 leagues upon your starboard quarter, what would be your nearest English port?
Again I had to give it up.
Well, I don't see that your geography is much better than your history, said he.
Who would never get your certificate at this rate?
Can you do addition?
Well, then, let us see if you can tot up my prize money.
He shot a mischievous glance at my mother as he spoke, and she laid down her knitting on her lap and looked very earnestly at him.
You never asked me about that, Mary, said he.
The Mediterranean is not the station for it, Anson.
I have heard you say that it is the Atlantic for prize money and the Mediterranean for honor.
I had a share of both last cruise, which comes from changing a line of battleship for a frigate.
Now, Rodney, there are £2 in every 100 due to me when the prize courts have done with them.
When we were watching Messina, off Genoa, we got a matter of 70 schooners, bricks, and tartans, with wine, food, and powder.
Lord Keith will want his finger in the pie, but that's for the courts to settle.
Put them at £4 apiece to me, and what will the 70 bring?
£280, I answered.
Why, Anson, it is a fortune, cried my mother, clapping her hands.
Try you again, Roddy, said he, shaking his pipe at me.
Here was the Zebek frigate out of Barcelona with 20,000 Spanish dollars aboard, which make 4,000 of our pounds.
Her hull should be worth another 1,000.
What's my share of that?
£100.
Why, the purser couldn't work it out quicker, he cried in his delight.
Here's for you again.
We passed the Straits and worked up to the Azores, where we fell in with the La Sabina from the Mauritius with sugar and spices.
£1,200 she's worth to me, Mary, my darling, and never again shall you soil your pretty fingers, or pinch upon my beggarly pay.
My dear mother had borne her long struggle without a sign all these years, but now that she was so suddenly eased of it, she fell sobbing upon his neck.
It was a long time before my father had a thought to spare upon my examination in arithmetic.
It's all in your lap, Mary, said he, dashing his own hand across his eyes.
Why, George, lass, when this leg of mine is sound we'll bear down for a spell to Brighton, and if there is a smarter frock than yours upon the stang, may I never tread a poop again.
But how is it that you are so quick at figures, Rodney, when you know nothing of history or geography?
I tried to explain that addition was the same upon sea or land, but that history and geography were not.
Well, he concluded, you need figures to take a reckoning, and you need nothing else save what your mother wit will teach you.
There never was one of our breed who did not take to salt water like a young gull.
Lord Nelson has promised me a vacancy for you, and he'll be as good as his word.
So it was that my father came home to us, and a better or kinder no lad could wish for.
Though my parents had been married so long, they had really seen very little of each other, and their affection was as warm and as fresh as if they were two newly wedded lovers.
I have learned since that sailors can be coarse and foul, but never did I know it from my father, for, although he had seen as much rough work as the wildest could wish for, he was always the same patient, good-humored man, with a smile and a jolly word for all the village.
He could suit himself to his company too, for on the one hand he could take his wine with the vicar, or with Sir James Ovington, the squire of the parish,
While on the other he would sit by the hour amongst my humble friends down in the Smiley, with Champion Harrison, Boy Jim, and the rest of them, telling them such stories of Nelson and his men, that I have seen the champion nod his great hands together, while Jim's eyes have smoldered like the forge embers as he listened. My father had been placed on half pay, like so many others of the old war officers, and so, for nearly 2 years, he was able to remain with us. During all this time I can only once remember that there was the slightest disagreement between him and my mother. It chanced that I was the cause of it, and as great events sprang out of it, I must tell you how it came about. It was indeed the first of a series of events which affected, not only my fortunes, but those of very much more important people. The spring of 1803 was an early one, and the middle of April saw the leaves thick upon the chestnut trees. One evening we were all seated together over a dish of tea, when we heard the scrunch of steps outside our door, and there was the postman with a letter in his hand. "I think it is for me," said my mother, and sure enough it was addressed in the most beautiful writing to Mrs. Mary Stone, of Friar's Oak, and there was a red seal the size of a half crown upon the outside of it with a flying dragon in the middle. "Whom think you that it is from, Anson?" she asked. "I had hoped that it was from Lord Nelson," answered my father. "Tea is time the boy had his commission. But if it be for you, then it cannot be from anyone of much importance." "Can it not?" she cried, pretending to be offended. "Who will ask my pardon for that speech, sir, for it is from no less a person than Sir Charles Tregellis, my own brother." My mother seemed to speak with a hushed voice when she mentioned this wonderful brother of hers, and always had done, as long as I can remember, so that I had learned also to have a subdued and reverent feeling when I heard his name. And indeed it was no wonder, for that name was never mentioned, unless it were in connection with something brilliant and extraordinary. Once we heard that he was at Windsor with the king. Often he was at Brighton with the prince. Sometimes it was as a sportsman that his reputation reached us, as when his meteor beat the Duke of Queensberry's Egham at Newmarket, or when he brought Jim Belcher up from Bristol and sprang him upon the London fancy. But usually it was as the friend of the great, the arbiter of fashions, the king of bucks, and the best-dressed man in town that his reputation reached us. My father, however, did not appear to be elated at my mother's triumphant rejoinder. "Eh, and what does he want?" asked he, in no very amiable voice. "I wrote to him, Anson, and told him that Rodney was growing a man now, thinking, since he had no wife or child of his own, he might be disposed to advance him. We can do very well without him," growled my father. "He sheered off from us when the weather was foul, and we have no need of him now that the sun is shining." "Nay, you misjudge him, Anson," said my mother, warmly. "Here is no one with a better heart than Charles, but his own life moves so smoothly that he cannot understand that others may have trouble. During all these years I have known that I had but to say the word to receive as much as I wished from him. Thank God that you never had to stoop to it, Mary. I want none of his help. But we must think of Rodney. Rodney has enough for his sea chest and kit. He needs no more. But Charles has great power and influence in London. He could make Rodney known to all the great people. Surely you would not stand in the way of his advancement." "Let us hear what he says, then," said my father, and this was the letter which he read to him. 14, Jermyn Street, St. James, April 15, 1803. "My dear sister Mary, in answer to your letter, I can assure you that you must not conceive me to be wanting in those finer feelings which are the chief adornment of humanity. It is true that for some years, absorbed as I have been in affairs of the highest importance, I have seldom taken a pen in hand, for which I can assure you that I have been reproached by many day plus charmants of your charming sex. At the present moment I lie abed, having stayed late in order to pay a compliment to the Marchioness of Dover at her ball last night, and this is writ to my dictation by Ambrose, my clever rascal of a valet. I am interested to hear of my nephew Rodney, mon Dieu, quel nom! comma, and as I shall be on my way to visit the prince at Brighton next week, I shall break my journey at Friar's Oak for the sake of seeing both you and him. Make my compliments to your husband. I am ever, my dear sister Mary, your brother, Charles Tregellis. What do you think of that? Cried my mother in triumph, when as he had finished. I think it is the letter of a fop, said my father, bluntly. You are too hard on him, Anson. You will think better of him when you know him. But he says that he will be here next week, and this is Thursday, and the best curtains unhung, and no lavender in the sheets. Away she bustled, half distracted, while my father sat moody, with his chin upon his hands, and I remained lost in wonder at the thought of this grand new relative from London, and of all that his coming might mean to us. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.